This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 457 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I'm joined by our favorite aviation historian, David Vanderhoof.
Hey, Max. Guess where we are?
We are at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum for their annual Father's Day weekend event, Innovations in Flight. How many years have we been here, David, for that?
I think we did started doing this in 2010.
Wow. You know, this is such a fantastic museum that even if you just keep coming back here over and over again, there's still so much to see, so much to do. So we're out on the floor, as usual. And what do we have here behind us, David?
Actually, it's kind of funny because our friend Jennifer from a small Midwestern airport asked me on my way down what my favorite airplane was in this museum. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and it prevented me from worrying about the traffic I was sitting in. And I came up with the Dornier DO-335 Aardvark, or FEAR. Feel. Ironically, that's what we're sitting in front of. The original pull me super fighter from Germany in World War II.
I don't know. That was seems like fate, David. It really does. But that's pretty exciting. Now, we're going to do a couple of things this episode. We've got some interviews that we're going to conduct. We're going to talk to a lot of people, as many as we can. We certainly want to get outside where there's many, many aircraft, and some of our friends are out there as well. Some of them have flown in.
Absolutely. So I think we probably should get this show on the road. What do you think?
All right, let's get started. Now we're speaking with Lieutenant General Chris Noland. He's the Director of Operations for the U.S. Air Force. General, thanks for stopping by.
Oh, Max, it's my pleasure to be here. What an amazing day.
This is a great day. There are so many people here. And what I particularly like is the number of young people here, the kids that are here. Families have brought their youngsters who are just so absorbed with all the aviation around us. It's just great.
It is fabulous. And, you know, it's super important because we need to return the luster to aviation, and we need to get young people excited about a flying career.
Absolutely, and I think that's probably a large part of why you are here today.
Absolutely. I have an opportunity to speak, and my goal is to talk about our 70th anniversary. Air Force, 70 years come September. Of course, we've been in the flying business for a long time, but we had that little part with the Army Air Corps, and you know, we don't need to go into that.
No, we'll stick with the main part, the 70-year part.
So we talked about a career in the Air Force. Tell us a little bit, General, about your career. How did you come up, and where did you go to school, and what have you flown? And give us a little background on your history.
Sure. So we find that this is actually happening more and more. My dad was a Air Force pilot, so I'm a second-generation Air Force officer. And I'm going to tell stories. I grew up at Edwards Air Force Base in kind of what I would consider the golden era of flight tests. We had the F-15, F-16. The space shuttle was all going on there. So I caught the bug early. So I went to the Air Force Academy, graduated from the Air Force Academy in 1985. And then I've been privileged to see the world. I've been in Europe. I've been all over the United States. And I've had the opportunity to fly a bunch of airplanes, starting with the T-41. And gliders back at the Air Force Academy. And then moving my way up to T-37s, T-38s, and then I was fortunate to get into F-15 C models, flew C models for a long time, and then came back to UPT, and where I was flying the T-38Cs and then the T-6. And then I was really, really lucky in my last job to have the chance to fly the A-10 Warthog.
We have a big Warthog fan in this organization.
It's a fabulous airplane.
I grew up, my father was base civil engineer at Willow Grove for the Air Force, and we had Air National Guard. Our PA Air National Guard was A-10s, and my dad's unit was 130s. So I grew up with the A-10s floating around. So what's your favorite part about the A-10?
Well, what I like about the A-10, it's like the F-15C. It's got two tails, two engines, one pilot, one mission. The difference being in the C model, our job was to gain and maintain air supremacy, so that's all we focused on. The A-10's mission is close air support and attack. And when you shoot that 30-millimeter gun, you get it.
Yeah. Drone Mom is over here nodding her head vigorously.
Yeah. I think the first time we saw one in the sheet metal, if you will, was at the Pima Air and Space Museum, I think, in Arizona. And we could go right up to the A-10. And I have this photograph somewhere of Drone Mama here with her arm wrapped around that cannon in front. I think big guns she's always attracted to, but...
I'm not going to touch that one, Max. Okay, I'm going to let that one alone.
I'm thinking, as I said, it's the words came out. I was thinking, don't go down that path.
So, General, tell us a little bit. What is the Air Force doing for their birthday? This is a big milestone. 70 is pretty middle-aged for an Air Force, huh?
You know, it's amazing. Because I had my previous job, I also had the opportunity to travel the world and in South America. And, you know, we're actually one of the younger Air Forces. There's Air Forces that claim 100 years because of the way they were developed. But for its 70 is awesome. And our theme is powered by innovation. And if you think of how innovative airmen are, airmen think differently. And I think if you look through our history, we can prove it because of the way we innovate and the way we think. Exploiting that third dimension has caused us to do a lot of neat things from the A-10 all the way up to space to today. If you think about what we're doing in space and as we look to the future, it's only going to get more innovation is going to be required.
And you mentioned the need to get more people involved in aviation and in flying to satisfy this demand for pilots. And this is something that certainly the commercial aviation industry is concerned about, but also the military as well.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, our chief of staff, the Air Force, just last month hosted a national pilot sourcing forum, which was it was industry, education, the military, and we all got together to talk about how we have shared common interest, and our one common interest is producing more pilots.
What's the personality type of the perfect pilot? What kinds of people should consider a career in flying like that?
Well, you know, one of our problems is I think we have a lot of barriers, and we need to open up. I don't think there is a perfect personality besides somebody who gets excited about breaking the ground and getting up in the air. That's all that's required. Of course, there is some technical capability, but to a certain extent, we're looking at what are the... You know, there's been a real focus on science, technology, engineering, and math degrees. And to a certain extent, we might be putting up artificial barriers there. So we're going to take a look at what are the right skill sets that you have to have a successful aviation career.
I'm just shifting topics a little bit. Director of Operations, what does that involve? What's the scope of that position?
It is an incredible job. I feel privileged to be the Air Force Director of Operations. Essentially, I monitor, I don't do them, but we set up policy and then we monitor all the Air Force operations all over the globe. And so your United States Air Force, is a globally engaged force. And people forget how much we do because they kind of take it for granted because we're always there. We are always there for the joint force. I'll just give you a little example for your listeners. Anybody out there this week that's going to go get gas and put your credit card and pull it out, or you go to an ATM and you slide that and you get that. That's all provided by your United States Air Force, because we fly the constellation of GPS that that does the timing for the banking industry around the world.
Huh. So there's an application that you wouldn't, the average person wouldn't realize.
Yeah, they would have no, we do it, and we're just always there for people. And so we're involved in Iraq and Syria. Every 2.3 minutes, a tail with the United States Fin Flash is taking off somewhere around the world to move logistics, cargo, people, or to go to a command and control mission, or to go a global surveillance reconnaissance mission for a combatant commander. So the one thing that I can tell you about my job is it never stops.
Well, as those of you who are listening can't tell, I mean, maybe you can hear the enthusiasm in the general's voice, but you can't see the smile that's been across his face almost this entire conversation. David, I think this is somebody who's really enjoys their job.
Yeah, it's nice and positive. It's nice to hear positive things about the Air Force. And let's just dive a little bit more about piloting. What do you think about remotely piloted aircraft going forward and that division of the Air Force?
Oh, there. Well, first of all, we got to dispel a rumor. You know, we call them unmanned aerial vehicles, which was a mistake. And then people call them drones, and that's a mistake. We call them in the Air Force remotely piloted aircraft because they are absolutely being piloted. And I think the future of the Air Force is a combination of manned and remotely piloted aircraft, because they give us capabilities that people just don't understand, and they take the human out of the loop, which gives you persistence that you can't get when you've got a pilot in it. So the future is a mixture of manned and remotely piloted aircraft, and it's really, really exciting when you think about it. And for anyone out there that really wants to think about how do you get youngsters back into aviation, I would encourage them to think about small unmanned aerial systems.
Yeah, that's something that when we've talked to folks from AOPA, they've also brought that up, that drones, if you will, you know, small quadcopters, the kinds of UAVs that consumers can purchase is a great gateway to an aviation career.
Absolutely, because think about it, and particularly if you're a mom and dad and you want to, if your son or daughter doesn't think that they can do the math or they can't understand circuits and everything and all that, what you need to do is get them hooked into this, because first of all, when they fly them and when you put the goggles on, they're going to learn about lift, roll, thrust, yaw. They're going to learn all those things. Then if you make them work on them, they're going to learn about electrical engineering, because they're going to learn about circuit boards. Then they're going to learn about the link, because the data link is the key to that whole. And then they're going to learn about video. So if you want to start getting your youngster into skill sets that are going to be critical for the future, you could get them hooked on this and they before you even know it. So it's a great entree to think about.
It's perfect, and it's sort of self-building. If they have the interest, yeah, they'll take those next steps and develop. And I mean, you just have to kind of get them started and just watch it blossom from there.
Yeah, get them hooked. Realize it could be a little expensive as they crash a few of these things.
Yes.
But that's why you have them rebuild them and work on
and
them.
Learn there, too, as well.
Absolutely. And the beauty is there's enough stuff online, like a podcast, or that you could go online and learn how to do it.
Yes, perfect. All right, General, that's been a great conversation.
Absolutely. Thank you for being on the show, and thank you for your service. And hopefully maybe we can have you back for the 75th birthday.
If I'm still around at the 75th, we'll see about that. So, hey, thank you guys for what you do. Thanks for promoting aviation. It's important because this is... it's about the community, and it really is all of us. And so even your name, Airplane Geek, I love, because, you know, when you're in a place like this and you look at the It's just amazing. By the way, the Pima Air and Space Museum, if you've never visited, is an awesome museum.
It is. It is.
And also the Air Museum, the Air Force Museum
in Dayton, Ohio
is an unbelievable place.
Yeah, those are those two and this here, the three must-visit aviation
museums.
Okay,
and I got to say Pensacola, too.
All right, David likes Pensacola.
That's the top three.
Pensacola is a great museum also. I ran the Blue Angel Marathon down there, so yeah, it's a fun place to go.
Well, again, thank you very much for your time, and we'll hopefully talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank
Adios.
You. Bye-bye. We were really pleased to see Caroline Sheen stop by. She's the photography and art editor of Air and Space Magazine. Caroline, that is a fantastic magazine. We always have enjoyed it for years and years. The photography and art editor, how long have you been in that position?
I've been with Air and Space Smithsonian Magazine since the very first issue, which came out in 1986. So I'm admitting I've been there a long time. And it's I've learned a lot about aviation and space in those 30 years, obviously. And it's great fun, and I'm very proud of the magazine.
So what is the role of the photography editor? I mean, what is your job really all about?
What my job is to find photographs to support the various stories that we do, whether it's archival history. I come to the archives here at the Uvar Hazy Center and work with Melissa and Brian looking for great pictures. I work with photographers, assign photographers to specific stories. And sometimes I take some of the photographs myself.
Ah.
As a print is, you know, it's hard to keep magazines going, so our photography budget has shrunk quite a bit. So I find myself in that position, that fortunate position, to take a few photographs here and there.
Lots of people take pictures of airplanes or photographs that have some kind of an aviation theme. Some people are really, really good at it. Some people are spectacular at it.
Yes.
Do you face a flood of photos, or is it difficult to find just the kind of photograph that you want?
Well, I'm fortunate that there are so many wonderful aviation photographers in our community, and they specifically do a lot of air-to-air photo shoots. So I can list, you know, off the top of my head, about 10 photographers, Paul Bowen, Chad Slattery, Lyle Jadsma. There's you know, just dozens. Jim Kepnick is one of the best photographers out there, and he covered Oshkosh at Air Venture many, many years. David Carlson. I respect what all of them do very much.
So what's your favorite air-to-air shoot? You get the privilege of doing it occasionally. So what's one of those memorable shoots that you got to do hanging out of an airplane?
The photo shoot air-to-air that I did was an Air Venture, was of the vintage aircraft like the Fokker, the triplane, and the Newport 28, some of those very early aircraft. And I actually have a photograph of a P-51 Mustang flying with a Fokker, which you can imagine the speeds vary on those. So to get those in the same frame was a bit of a challenge. But I particularly like early aviation, World War I aircraft. And so I would say that was my favorite opportunity.
Do you have any tips for, let's say, amateur photographers or those who maybe aspire to be more than that? Some tips about how to take great photos of airplanes or aviation topics?
Well, certainly I always advise people to look at the books, for instance, that some of the best photographers have done, and that would be John Dibbs, again, Paul Bowen. You can see, just paging through their books, how the photographs, for instance, the prop on a prop plane needs to be moving. If you've got a frozen prop, it shows that you're an amateur. So you have to make sure your settings. But, you know, technical, any of these photographers will be happy to pass along information they have in making good air-to-air pictures. My particular, as a photo editor, what I look for, I mean, air-to-air, there's a lot of good air-to-air photographs out there, but what I look for are people and planes. So whether you're going to a small little airport or an air show, I find it more difficult to find people either working on an airplane, climbing into the cockpit, you know, a lot of little kids crowding around the plane asking questions. It's the people on planes, that humanity, that everybody likes the topic of aviation.
Max, she's telling me that I'm doing it wrong all these years as I wait patiently for the people to get out of my photograph of the lovely airplane.
That is so funny. No, you need to wait until those colorful little kids or the perfect guy with the big hat comes walking into the frame and he's looking at this airplane. That's when you're at Oshkosh, for instance, so many times I think people wait for everybody to just clear away so they get this static, I consider boring photograph of this lovely airplane, but it has no personality because you don't have the people.
There's no way I'm going to get people in my photographs. I want that lovely airplane. I will try. It's going to be a hard habit to break, but I will try for you.
And I understand that you submitted something to our photo contest.
I did. When I was privileged to fly with the Blue Angels and the Sky Typers, I did air-to-air and hanging. It was probably one of the most nerve-wracking 20 minutes of my life trying to orchestrate, like you said, the P-51 and the Fokker. Having F-18s with T-6s trying to be in the same photograph, hanging out the side of an airplane, it was a very interesting experience.
So you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
But you also wanted us to talk a little bit about something that's coming out this week, a collector's edition about something that we don't talk enough about, but our listeners love, and that's space.
Correct. We Air and Space Magazine produces two collector's editions per year, and the topic for the one that's about to hit the newsstands, subscribers do not get this, it's only on the newsstands, it's called The 50 Greatest Moments of the Space Age, and it's a wonderful, inspiring history of space exploration in 50 bite-sized pieces. And it's got a lot of stunning photographs, I can say that because I'm the photo editor. And I think you'll find a lot of interesting little tidbits in there. For example, the photograph that everybody knows so well of John Glenn and the other Mercury astronauts, they didn't have their silver space boots ready for their big, important Life magazine portrait. And so they wore work boots spray-painted with silver instead. And I think people are familiar with that photograph and may not have known, but if you look at their boots, you will see what I'm talking about.
They're spray-painted. That's hysterical.
You also had an interesting story about the first dog in space and how his ground crew was pretty humane to the pup.
Correct. Before they launched Laika, the Russian engineers brought a bowl of water to the launch pad and, in violation of launch protocols, opened her space capsule to give her a drink. So isn't that, you know, very thoughtful of the Russians?
Well, and so this episode is available where?
This magazine is going to be on the newsstand. It will be up. It'll be out on Monday. The 50 Greatest Moments of the Space Age. And it's got a terrific cover designed by our art director, Ted Lopez. And I hope it appeals to some of those space lovers out there.
Oh, I'm going to go look for it right away. I called it an episode. There's my podcast. I should have said issue.
Everything in our lives anymore is an episode. It's just one episodic piece of material after another. But, Caroline, thank you for stopping by, and thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, Max, there's a lot of things out on the flight line, and one of them is a emergency response truck. And with that emergency response truck from the FAA, we have Christopher Watson, who's the project manager for the Command and Control Communications Programs. Chris, thank you for being on Airplane Geeks.
Well, thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about what you do for a living for the FAA.
Yes, within the FAA, I am the program manager for the communications support team, which is an element of the Office of National Security Programs and Emergency Response. The communications support team responds to natural disaster relief, to accident sites, to special security events or other special events, and to anywhere where the FAA administrator requires supplemental communications or mobile command post.
And what you brought outside was the mobile command post, correct?
That's right. It's our emergency response vehicle. The emergency response vehicle is capable of providing a standalone, climate-controlled office environment. We have an onboard generator and onboard satellite systems, so we can go anywhere in the country, and within about 45 minutes of arrival, we can set up a completely standalone office on wheels for anyone in the FAA or from another agency to manage an incident or an emergency.
Now, David's been outside and has seen the vehicle. I haven't seen it yet. Can you describe, what does this look like?
Well, it really looks like a big white truck, like a box truck, except it has doors on it and an antenna on the top, numerous antennas actually. Within the vehicle, we have six workspaces which provide a phone and a data connection. The vehicle also contains a video teleconference suite, some air-to-ground radio, the national airspace picture in the form of ads, and two high-definition direct TV feeds.
Is there just one of these?
There is only one emergency response vehicle. However, we also have other smaller assets that can be placed on pallets and moved to an incident location by cargo air transport more easily than the large truck.
So normally you would drive the truck to the site?
The truck is normally driven to an event site, yes.
Okay.
So, Chris, tell us a little bit about your background. How did you get to this position with the FAA?
Well, for the first 20 years of my career, I was an Army signal officer, and when I retired from active service in 2011, I was looking for opportunities that involved command and control communications, national security, and obviously public service. An opportunity at the FAA came up. I was selected for the position, and I've been here for about 6 years.
Very cool, and thank you for your service.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, so tell us, what would happen? So when you say a disaster, so you have a crash, you deploy this vehicle, and that becomes the FAA's mobile headquarters in a way?
Well, really, it would be best to consider the vehicle to be an extension of the Washington Operations Center in D.C. For a natural disaster, our prototypical scenario that we plan for most often is a major hurricane. So for a Category 3, 4, or 5 hurricane making landfall in Florida, for instance, that hurricane might result in damage to an air traffic control center or to another FAA facility. The members of our team and our equipment would not directly repair that facility, but we would provide an environment for all those people who are managing that recovery effort to operate from. So they could come into the mobile command post, do their reports, fill out their pay sheets, conduct a video teleconference with the administrator in the headquarters, and make phone calls, do whatever they needed in order to facilitate that recovery operation.
Hmm. Chris, can you think of some examples of recent deployments of the vehicle?
Well, we're very fortunate in that in recent years we've not had very many major hurricanes make landfalls. We've also not had any major commercial airplane crashes that we'd needed to respond to. So most of our missions in recent months and years have been to special events. The event here today at the Udvar-Hazy Center is a special event, and it would come under public outreach and education for us. Other special events that we've done recently include the inauguration and the presidential address to a joint session of Congress. So that's a good example of the type of event which is short in duration and, because of the high profile of the event, may require extra support for law enforcement or other agencies in terms of awareness of the national airspace picture or the ability to communicate with our agency. And that's where the mobile command post would come in.
Wow, that's cool. I would never think the inauguration or a joint the FAA would be having a mobile command center for a joint session of Congress. That's pretty neat.
Well, in the case of the presidential address to Congress, we don't deploy to the Capitol building or the National Mall. We actually deploy to another location where the vehicle is set up and available if it should be needed. But we're not actually on site. We did support the event, though.
Very cool.
Now, here you're giving tours of the vehicle, speaking to people.
We are. We can show people outside the vehicle, and of course, everyone's also welcome to come inside to see the National Airspace Picture, to see our other systems like the video teleconference, and we hope everyone will stop by.
What kind of questions do you get from the people here at the museum?
We get a lot of questions, and the questions generally vary by age group. Our younger visitors are fascinated by our surveillance camera system. We do have the ability, with a camera located on the top of our mast, to take a live video picture of anything in the area of our truck and to transmit that over satellite back to FAA headquarters. But because the camera is a pan-tilt zoom, all the younger visitors love to manipulate the camera and see what's in the nearby area. The older visitors are generally more aviation savvy, and they tend to ask questions about the ads display of the National Airspace Picture. What do the various icons mean? How can they tell which type of plane is flying in what area, what altitude, what speed and direction, and things of that nature?
Okay, Chris, we'll let you do your public service announcement. Max and I love drones, and we're big FAA fans, and we know that you love a certain application on iPhones and Google. And what is that application?
That application is the Before You Fly app. It's available for both iPhone, for iOS, on the Apple Store, on the App Store, and also for Android on Google. We strongly encourage anyone who owns or plans to own and operate a UAV to log on to that app at any time. The app will provide an immediate indicator whether or not you're allowed to operate your UAV at your present location. It will also allow you to plan future flights, and it contains links to the FAA websites for requirements and other information.
Yeah, it's a really nicely done app, too. I think it's very easy to use and intuitive, and I enjoy it. Sometimes I'll just bring it up when I'm in a location that I'm not going to be flying anything, but just to see what it says about the area.
Exactly. You can use that app at any location where you have mobile service to plan a future flight, and that's very useful, and we encourage everyone to do it if they are planning a future flight of a UAV.
Well, Chris, thank you for being on the show. Very informative, and thank you for bringing the vehicle. And well, I guess we'll get some pictures up on our website of it. And it's great to see another aspect of the FAA that we don't normally get to hear about. So thank you for being on the show.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, we were walking around the museum, and we noticed a very familiar-looking quadcopter. This is the multirotor. This is the Amazon Prime Air vehicle, and we're talking with
Harry Hartfield from Amazon Prime Air.
And, Harry, tell us a little bit about the vision that Amazon Prime Air has. What do you guys want to do?
Yeah, our goal is to create a super fast delivery system for our customers that will get them packages of 5 pounds or less in 30 minutes or less.
And because as we've known that most of the deliveries, Amazon deliveries, are that lighter weight, yeah. And people that live close to distribution centers.
Yeah, so 90% of the packages we send are 5 pounds or less. And what's great about this is we hear from people all the time about those last-minute needs that they forgot about, whether it's a family project, or you run out of dog food, or you run out of baby food, or you run out of diapers, and you don't want to go to the store. This will bring it to you in 30 minutes or less.
Now, this drone, this UAV that we're looking at here, is a prototype. Is this pretty close, do you think, to what we're going to see in the end?
So this is the first model we developed. It's the one you saw on the 60 Minute story, if you're familiar with that one. We now have more than 12 different models designed for different climates, different reasons. And so we envision a multiple different drones.
So each would be specific to the environment that it's in. You don't just see one kind of drone being used globally.
Yeah, so we've developed more than 12 at this moment, and we see that uses for multiple of them, yeah.
Now, when we have conversations about package delivery by drone, there's lots of, you know, what-ifs that come up. What if the dog gets after the drone, things like that. Do you land the drone on the ground, or do you drop it you know, via some device or something. What's the thinking now with Amazon?
Yeah, so we've been clear from day one that safety is the most important feature of this, and we are developing some of the most advanced sense and technology, sense and avoid technology in the world. And so this technology will make sure that it doesn't land on your dog or your kid's head. It can actually detect a thin wire over your property and will know to avoid it. So we are very confident that these will be incredibly safe, and we won't fly them until we know they're completely safe.
Is that kind of development all happening internally within Amazon, or are there other parties involved?
So we build our drones in Seattle. We test them in the U.S. as well as it doing deliveries itself in Cambridge, and we develop our drones from scratch, software and hardware.
What do you think are the biggest challenges that remain?
So we, so far in our initial trials in the UK, have heard overwhelmingly positive feedback from our customers. Once they get the service, they don't want to let it go, as you can imagine. So one of the big challenges at the moment in the US is that this technology is relatively new, and the FAA doesn't currently allow us to do out of line of sight testing. So driving that drone farther than your eye can see. And so we're working with the FAA and regulators to make sure we can start to do deliveries in the U.S. in a safe manner and make sure the regulations keep up with the technology.
So if you polish up your crystal ball, do you have a timeline that you could offer?
So we don't have a timeline at the moment. We're excited about the feedback we're hearing in the U.K. We're hoping to do deliveries in the U.S., working with the FAA to make that a reality. And we're still perfecting and making sure the technology is safe and reliable and dependable.
Now, the group within Amazon that's doing all this work, is that a separate unit? And what are those people like, and where do they come from?
Yeah, so it's the primary unit, and we have some of the smartest people at all of Amazon, which is saying something. So we have everyone from, we have a former astronaut on our staff. We have people with multiple PhDs in aeronautics and software development. We have people who come from Google. We have people who come from NASA, and so everything in between. And I would say that the best asset of we have is the talent we have working on Primair.
I've got to believe they're pretty highly motivated, feeling like they're working on something. You know, their job involves something that's brand new. They're creating something that doesn't exist. So they must be really pumped up.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that we've been able to attract so many talented people, is that Amazon is really on the cutting edge of this technology and innovating drones in a way that no one else in this field is really doing.
So just finally, here at the Air and Space Museum, as people walk by, what kind of reaction are you getting? What kinds of questions are people asking?
People are really excited about this. You know, they want, when you explain to them that they can get their kids' shoes in 30 minutes or less, they ask where they can sign up. And so I think we've always been clear that this is about what our customers need, and our customers have been very excited about the idea.
Well, we're all excited, too. We obviously follow the adventures of Amazon Prime Air and the package delivery industry and development in general. So we'll continue to do that. Best of luck to Amazon. And we can talk to you in the future about it as well.
Great. Thanks. Nice to talk to you.
All right. Why don't you tell us your name?
My name's Catherine.
And where are you from, Catherine?
I'm from San Diego, so from the West Coast.
And so what are you doing here on the East Coast?
We're doing our East Coast trip for our middle school right now.
And so how many of you are here today at the museum?
Total, there's about 200.
200? And is everybody here today?
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's great. That's great. So you've been walking around, and there's a lot to see here. You've probably only seen a small portion of it so far. Is there something that you've really enjoyed looking at, or somebody that you've met or talked to? What have you seen so far that you like?
I think the Discovery Space Shuttle over there in the corner section,
yeah,
is it really cool, because you could see all the effects that space had on it when it like came out and then came back in. You could see the marks of, like, you know, it going through the atmosphere, and I found that really cool.
Yeah, that's one of the really nice things about this museum, is that a lot of things are in their original condition. They're not restored to be perfect. They want to kind of capture things as they were.
You want to know what one of the funny questions everybody asks is about Discovery?
Mm-hmm.
And you'd be very disappointed there's a lot of people who ask when are they going to clean it?
The answer is never.
Never. It's and you're the precise audience because you appreciate all of that. It's been back and forth to space several times.
Mm-hmm.
How was it when you first saw it? Was it bigger than you thought? Smaller than you thought? What did you think when you first saw it? Because it's kind of impressive when you walk by the way they've got it, you know, in that hangar there.
Yeah. From its original state, I think it was slightly bigger than I anticipated, but it was around the size that I might have thought since, you know, from movies, you see that stuff and you just approximate it.
Have you been outside yet?
No, because of the line, and then
you have to go through the safety briefing, and they stamp you, and then you can go in and out. And the line moves pretty quickly. David, you've been outside. What have you seen outside? What can she look forward to out there?
Well, there's a United, believe it or not, United brought a 787. So there's a Dreamliner. There's a lot of little airplanes. And there's some very cool military airplanes, F-18s, Super Hornets, and F-16s. And you'll have a good time. And there's a lot of people out there looking forward to meeting people like you from the other side of the country.
Very good. All right. Well, thanks for stopping by and have a lot of fun. You're going to be here all day, I imagine.
Yeah.
Good. You can probably see about a tenth of everything if you're here all day. But that's fun. And thanks again for talking with us.
Thank you.
All right. So Hillel Glaser is here with his plane. We saw him fly into Pittsburgh, and now here at the Uvarhazy Center. How was the flight in?
Once we got above the clouds, it was gorgeous. It's kind of a weird feeling knowing that you're only at 6,000 feet with a layer of clouds, thick clouds under you, and you think you're at 30,000 feet, but no, you're only at 6. But so it was really, really nice for the vast majority of the cruise portion. But then during when we got below closer to 3,000 on approach and arrival and approach, we were back into the soup for the rest of the flight, following very closely to the instrument landing system needles because there was supposed to be an airport out there somewhere, which we didn't see until less than 2 miles from the end of the runway. And I could actually use kind of broken clouds here and there, so I actually could see other portions of the runway other portions of the airport before I could see my runway.
That's always dramatic.
Yeah, so like as soon as it broke out and saw the runway dead ahead, we're like, okay, that's a beautiful sight. But otherwise, an uneventful. For fun, though. The air traffic control keeps asking you, can you max forward, you know, meaning, you know, go as fast as you can forward. I'm like, okay, let me do that. So I monitored kind of like they did to Pittsburgh. I'm sitting there watching the red line on the engine and getting it just above the red line in a nose-down attitude to pick up as much speed as I could. But that's no way to fly an instrument landing system. I had to kind of give that up once, you know, I was kind of meandering all over the needles. I'm like, that's not going to work. So I powered back to what's supposed to be a normal power setting for actually doing an instrument approach.
So who came in with you?
My son Jacob accompanied me again this year, second time he's flown in with me, but he's been to this event with me many times.
Yeah, great.
And so we just keep enjoying it. It's too bad so many planes didn't make it in because of the weather.
It's cleared up now. I mean, we got blue sky and bright sun.
Yeah, for the time being, it's here. I don't know what it looks like somewhere else where some of these other planes are coming from. Normally, they line us up along the ramp according to oldest to newest. Uh-huh. And I kind of am the oldest plane here, except for maybe that Cessna 170 that might be a little older than me. But oh, okay. The OB-10 is a little older than us, but
sure.
But other than that, no. This is one of the oldest planes here today, which is really kind of sad.
Well, tell us a little bit about the plane.
So it's a 1972 Piper Cherokee 180. Many people would call it an Archer, but they actually didn't change the name till later in the same model year, because back then they didn't have product management and marketing talking to each other. And so, but it's got a bunch of meaning. It's 180 horsepower engine, and it's fixed gear. fixed pitch prop, so I don't have I don't change the pitch of the prop as I'm flying along. So this is a very basic aircraft. It's very popular among training because it's so basic. So if you're going to do primary flight training, you're likely to fly in something similar to this or Cessna 150, 172, that kind of class of aircraft. So it's pretty. Pretty easy on the controls, there's a table full of old electronics sitting here because I had to get all that replaced eventually to be ADS-B compliant with the 2020 mandate. And this plane had original equipment from when it was manufactured for navigation, which at this point made them unserviceable. I couldn't simply get the simplest ADS-B upgrade out there. I had to get a lot of other stuff. So that's if I convinced the Smithsonian that showing the 50-year-old tech next to the modern technology was an educational opportunity.
Yeah.
So I brought all that gear out. So I have a box of gear.
And you're all set now with ADS-B.
So now I'm all set with ADS-B. I've got integration between my panel and my iPad. So anything I do on the iPad or a panel, vice versa, is immediately updated, which is really convenient. I've got weather and traffic, but it's all integrated now. I don't have to have a separate thing hanging on the window to get weather and traffic. I can see, even though I could see it before with ADS-B, now I can get ADS-B air-to-air and ADS-B air-to-ground, which it gives you that much more visibility, and you see a lot of traffic. I know Max Trescott did a whole thing on ADS-B receivers.
Right, yeah.
And so, yeah, I know exactly what he's talking about, because the little receivers that you stick in the windows may or may not be able to do a lot of the stuff that the panel-mounted ones do. So I can see all kinds of traffic. And it's nice to know that they can see me.
Sure.
You had some interesting visitors earlier today.
Yeah. So I had a little girl who pushed every button in the plane and set off my emergency locator transmitter, my beacon. But more interesting was the owner prior to me came by to see the plane. He's a retired, well, many years retired. He's a Vietnam-era Marine Corps A-4 Skyhawk pilot, and he retired as a colonel. And he and his wife had this plane for 26 years before they sold it to me. And they follow our escapades around Facebook with the plane. And so we've become friends. And they came by and gave me a hug and gave the plane a kiss. And they wanted to, you know, took pictures of themselves inside the plane.
Sure,
and they're very, very complimentary of how we've been taking care of her. But they did, you know, they were first. They totally did a great job. But they privately commissioned this paint scheme, so I'm holding on to it. So it really means a lot to them, and it means a lot to me that they're so happy that to see us enjoying the plane as much as they did when basically they were our age.
How about amongst the general population here, folks attending the event? Are you getting lots of interesting questions? People stop by?
We're getting a lot. For people that can't see, we're right next to the entrance. So the first thing you see when you come out from your briefing is some World War II reenactment stuff. And then we're the first plane that you see because you come around the corner that's obstructed and you see a plane. So we get a lot of foot traffic, a lot of little kids. We're offering kids the opportunity to sit in the cockpit and sometimes put on the headset, and which is how we ended up with a little girl pushing all the buttons and the Air Force calling us. A lot of the kids like it. And, you know, I asked this one family walks by with two little girls, and I asked them, would you like to sit in the plane? And the girl lit up. She was just so delighted with this idea. Just her whole face just went, really? I mean, she didn't say it, but you could see it on her face. And I'm like, you're going in. And she just ran around the side, and we gave her a little pre-flight briefing on how to get in and what not to do. And she got in. And so I told Jacob later, my son, prioritize the little kids, prioritize the girls. We really need to get them interested, and we really need to get them to see that they can do this too. And while we didn't discriminate against anybody, we just said, if we're not busy, try to ask somebody if they want to come in. And if they happen to be girls, that's even better. But we had a steady stream of people. It's kind of thinned out quite a lot, I guess. Maybe the heat is keeping people from coming out. It got bright and sunny. It was cloudy and nice before, but it's gotten very hot. So, but for now, and also I think that it's going to stop letting people through in about half an hour, I think, something like that.
Yeah, plus we're waiting for a flyover, a very interesting flyover.
Yeah, I forgot about it and didn't even know what time it was until people were talking about it. And so, yeah, you'll probably want to get that on the mic if you want to hear it. But so we had a long, steady stream, a couple hours straight of kids coming up with their parents, and some parents too, and some older kids. And actually, one teenager, probably 15, 16, came up, and his mom asked me if I, if you know, can can he get in the plane? I'm like, I looked at myself. I'm like, of course you can get in the plane. So I showed him how to get in the plane, and he got in the plane, and then his parents were coaching him a little bit, you know, ask him some questions. And he's like, well, okay, so how do I get started? And I'm like, you know, find a flight school near you and use these words. Can I get a discovery flight? Yes. And that's how you get started. And his parents took notes, wrote that down. It's like, okay, discovery flight. Like, yes, that's it. Cost you maybe $100. Here it comes. Cost you $100, maybe more. Nice. Oh, that's low. A B-2.
All right, here's a B-2 flying overhead. Very low.
Definitely not pattern altitude.
No, and you know, until it's overhead and going past you, it really doesn't make that much sound. But it's look at that thing. That thing is amazing. There's a whole crowd of people I can see up on the hill outside. A big group of people that just watched the flyby. That was one of the events that this. Oh, there it is, from the other side of the building. Let's look at that. That's lit up by the sun. Because you just don't see an aircraft of that shape, of that configuration very often. So I think it's really had a big impact on the crowd here. We're just watching it fly. It's sort of along the horizon, along the tree line right now. Yeah, no, not he's not landing to here. I think David tells me that he's actually, I say he, I don't know if it's a he or a she, but they're actually doing a couple of events today.
Ocean City, Maryland,
I think maybe is the other one. And this is something they've done before in the past, is actually one aircraft cover some really significant distance and do flybys at more than one event. And I think that's what's happening. Yeah, and right on time, too. Right, hello.
I did get to see one in Andrews Air Force Base. They changed the name. It's no longer Andrews Air Force. It's like Joint Base Andrews or something like that. Years ago, when I used to go to the Andrews every the weekend before Memorial Day, Armed Forces Day weekend, used to be when Andrews would do their big open house.
Ah.
And I used to work for the Department of Defense at the time, so I could actually get in on the badge without having to go through all the lines. I'd go in through a back door. It was great. Yeah, but that was very cool.
So, that was very cool. I mean, it doesn't last very long, but it's really impressive to see. This, you know, again, we keep saying it on Airplane Geeks that there are, you know, several events that take place that are sort of must-attend events. And this one, every year, Father's Day weekend, I think fits into that category. There's so many people, so many folks of all different ages, different kinds of aircraft. We have a lot of GA stuff where I'm standing right now around Hillel's plane, and there's a bunch of military aircraft here as well, so... Maybe we'll head over in that direction and see if we can talk to some of the military pilots over there. All right, so Hillel, thanks. It's always good to see you. You're going to come to dinner tonight, right?
Yes, I'm going to come to dinner. We've worked out the driving arrangements. So the question is whether I actually have to find a hotel room tonight or I can fly home tonight. Yeah. Thunderstorms coming in and all that stuff. So.
Yes.
Did you know that there were going to be a 787?
No, I did not, actually.
Yeah, they said it was going to be a 777, which they say every year, and then they show up with a 76. And so I'm not complaining they showed up with a 787 this time.
Yeah, nice lines on that plane. Beautiful aircraft. United 787.
It's a 777 they show with an eclipse.
Yeah, put the eclipse next to it.
Hopefully no tree removal required this year.
That's right, because last year, when 2 years ago, when the 777 was taxiing over here from Dulles International, they discovered that the taxiway where they didn't clear
clearance, and they had to remove a tree. So an executive decision was made, and a tree was taken down to get the plane over here.
Because you can't just indiscriminately take down trees around here. Some permission, I think, was normally be required, but they did what needed to be done, and the 777 got in.
I did not know that story.
Yeah.
Did you see the Wonder Woman plane over there?
No.
It's kind of interesting.
What's the Wonder Woman plane?
It's an invisible plane.
a stealth plane?
Invisible.
It's like a really stealthy plane.
All right, well, I guess this is something I'm going to have to go and take a look at.
It's like a roped-off area with no plane in it.
And an easel with a description of the aircraft.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Lyle.
Good guys. See you later.
All right. Okay.
Here it comes again.
Oh, another pass. This time a little flatter, maybe.
Yeah, he's a lot flatter.
Yeah.
This is a slow
one. No wonder I can't take a picture. My camera's over there. Warning because he's so quiet.
I know.
Yeah, yeah.
Look at that 14, you could hear him 16 miles away.
That's right.
Very cool.
All right, David. Well, I think that's going to wrap this up. It's been a kind of a spectacular day. Did you have fun here, David?
That's a loaded question. Have I ever not had fun here? In fact, it's kind of nice. I've been basically desk monitoring, and while you've been able to go out and see the airplanes and stuff. And what did you just see fly over?
Well, Drone Mama and I were outside, and we were talking with Hillel, as you heard. And the B-2 bomber made a flyby. Actually, it came by twice. Both passes were low, pretty low. Second was even lower. What'd you think of that, Drone Mama? What'd you think of that B-2 bomber?
Well, I have to say, you know, there was an A-10 out on the tarmac, and I really loved the Warthog, but that B-2 was pretty spectacular. You don't see that every day.
No, you sure don't. You sure don't. And there's a lot of folks outside. Again, a lot of children, a lot of parents did a wonderful thing, brought their kids to this. And, you know, we've seen many examples of kids just lighting up over an airplane or something they've seen or something they've done, which is always great.
You know, I have to admit that I was watching the table, but it was kind of amazing watching the museum clear out to go outside to see the B-2 fly over. And being jaded and having seen that multiple times, I decided to let the rookies see it. But it's been a really good day. It's been a kind of a lower key day than we've had in the past. Not that that's a bad thing, but it's been as we're waiting for the narration to go by.
That's all right. Go ahead. Keep going.
Ambient noise. It's been a good day. Any day here that I can sit and watch people and watch airplanes is a good day. And looking forward to our meeting tonight with a bunch of people. So we're having a good day. It was good, Max and Lisa. You guys got to see the airplanes because usually Max is running around doing recordings. So we had some really good, interesting recordings.
Yeah, we talked to a number of great people. As always, there's others that we would have liked to have talked to, but you can't get everybody. And I think that this probably gives you a feel for what this event is like. And If you weren't able to make it this year, we hope that you'll come out next year. It's always Father's Day weekend, the Saturday in June before Father's Day. It's a great time. All right. So we'll wrap it up. And again, thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This has been episode 457. So you can find us at airplanegeeks.com, or you can go straight to the show notes for this episode at airplanegeeks.com/457.
Thanks for listening.